From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll learn about the lesser-known aspects of criminal sentencing.
Collateral consequences are the legal effects of a criminal conviction other than the traditional forms of punishments.
Later, Lake Effect's Susan Bentz reports on two significant votes in the state Senate yesterday.
Plus, we meet Wisconsin native Joe Kanosian, who has returned to Milwaukee to star in his award-winning two-person musical comedy, Murder for Two.
I always talk about how lucky we were, and it sounds like I'm being falsely modest, but we were so, so lucky. From the first reading to the first full production was less than a year, which never, ever, ever happens.
And we'll have an in-studio performance from the band Skipper's Alley. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Right now, there are more than 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, but that is just a small fraction of people with a criminal record.
More than 75 million people living in the United States have been convicted of some kind of crime, most of whom spend the majority of their lives in free society. But just because they've served their sentence, it doesn't mean they're free from consequences associated with their conviction.
Jack Chin is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis, and an expert on criminal law. He's in town to present this year's George and Margaret Barrick Lecture on Criminal Law at Marquette University, and joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about criminal justice's collateral consequences. And he starts by defining that term.
Collateral consequences are the legal effects of a criminal conviction other than the traditional forms of punishment. So everybody's familiar, of course, with the fact that if you're convicted of a crime, you might have to go to jail, you might have to go to prison, you might have to pay a fine, you might have to be on probation or parole. But on top of that, there are a bunch of other things that can happen to you. You can lose the right to vote. You can lose the right to serve on a jury. You can be deported. And depending on the crime, you can lose lots of other rights and privileges, such as the ability to possess a firearm, the ability to drive a car. You can lose public benefits. And one of the most significant things that happens to a lot of people is that they lose their right. They lose their job, or they lose their right to have a license or a permit that they need to be employed or be in business.
So who is generally responsible for these consequences? Are they local? Are they statewide or federal?
All of the above. So some of the most important consequences are imposed by the federal government on state convictions. For example, the federal government passed a law some years ago that said that essentially, all the states have to deprive people of driver's licenses if they've been convicted of a drug offense. And the federal government created an opportunity to opt out of that. But the federal government said, states, you have to do this or you're going to lose some federal funding. So that's one source. There's a number of collateral consequences imposed by the federal government. The federal government also makes it a crime to possess a firearm if you've been convicted of a federal or a state offense. The states also have a bunch of collateral consequences that they impose on their own, such as jury service and the right to vote, but also counties, cities, and agencies. So a lot of regulatory boards will say that you can't have a barber's license, you can't have a cosmetology license, you can't be an accountant. And these are not created by state law or federal law. They're created by an agency acting on its own. So they're really proliferating because so many levels of government and branches of government can create these collateral consequences.
So when people are convicted of a crime or when they're in a jury, are juries made aware of these consequences outside of the actual criminal conviction?
Generally, they're not. And for the most part, the Supreme Court and other courts have said that there is no duty on the part of either the judge or the defense attorney to advise the individual of the collateral consequences that might apply. Now, there is an exception. In 2010, in a case called Padilla versus Kentucky, the U.S. Supreme Court said that if the client in a criminal case is a non-citizen and they might be deported if they plead guilty or are convicted of the crime, then the defense attorney has to tell them that. But other things, for the most part, are, you know, some people call it the secret sentence or invisible punishment, because nobody has to tell the individual that this might happen. The jury doesn't necessarily know. The judge doesn't necessarily know. The lawyers don't necessarily know. And so these things a lot of times are surprises. To give you an example, in 2016, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that there was no obligation to tell somebody pleading guilty or being convicted of a sex offense that after they serve whatever time is imposed, whatever prison time is imposed, they might be subject to civil commitment afterwards. This seems to be pretty important, right? If you're getting, let's imagine, you're getting probation for a sex offense, the fact that you actually might be confined against your will, that would seem to be a pretty important consideration in deciding whether to go forward with that plea bargain or not, or how to handle that case. You know, do you mortgage your house to hire a lawyer or not? You know, how serious a problem is this? But the Supreme Court in this state said that it wasn't necessary for somebody to know that that was going to happen. So a lot of times people are surprised that they lose a vested public pension, for example, based on a particular criminal conviction, or they have to register as a sex offender or as some other sort of criminal offender.
Well, it seems problematic not just from the view of those who are convicted, but also of those who are convicting them, juries who don't really know what they're sentencing someone to. So when we look at Wisconsin specifically, what are some of the more kind of hidden sanctions that Wisconsin has?
Well, I will say that Wisconsin, of all the states, is one of the better states. And the reason for that is that your former public defender, Mike Tobin, his office put together some collections of major collateral consequences that apply based on convictions in this state. And so for the last 5 to 10 years, there has been better information available in Wisconsin than in most other states that defense lawyers can, if they choose, or probation officers can, if they choose, judges can, if they choose, use to inform people of what the real situation is. But, you know, typically among the things that happens, ineligibility for public benefits is a significant one for drug offenses and other sorts of offenses. You might get kicked out of public housing. And a lot of times this applies not just if the leaseholder is convicted of a drug offense, but if anyone in the unit is convicted of a drug offense. So the whole family can lose their housing based on an offense by one member. And so that's pretty significant. The occupational disqualifications, many professions have a restriction on people with convictions, you know, holding a license as an attorney, as a doctor, that sort of thing. And in some instances, that will make perfect sense. In some instances, a criminal conviction really will be associated with a danger to customers, patients, clients, etc. But it's not clear to me why a conviction for income tax evasion, for example, means somebody can't go hunting. I don't see the connection. But the law says that if you have a felony conviction, then you can't possess a firearm, that sort of thing. The American Bar Association, pursuant to a contract from the federal government, put together a collection of collateral consequences in all the states. And it looks like there's something like 40, 50,000 collateral consequences in statutes and regulations. You know, so something like 800 to 1,000 in every state, mostly dealing with occupational disqualification, mostly dealing with jobs that a person can't have if they have a particular felony conviction.
in Wisconsin, we've had a little bit of pushback to some of these collateral consequences, specifically the occupancy rules on sex offenders. So I believe it was Pleasant Prairie where a group of sex offenders sued the city in order to have a little bit more leeway in where they were allowed to live.
Right.
And we're seeing that now throughout the state to the point that a lot of cities are trying to kind of preempt the lawsuit by removing some of these regulations. Are we seeing similar pushback to any other collateral consequences in Wisconsin or throughout the country?
I think there is a recognition that there are costs to imposing too many collateral consequences. We want to protect the public. We want to protect public safety. But we have tens of millions of people with criminal record out there. There's something like 2 million people in prison, but 75 million people, adult Americans, with a criminal record. And if they can't work, if they can't make a living in the legitimate economy, that's a big problem for us. Because many of them, if they can't make an honest living, will make a dishonest living. And there's a cost to society when somebody who could have been reformed, when somebody who could have contributed to society and lived a law-abiding life instead recidivates and returns to crime. So one of the things that's happening in a lot of places around the country is something called ban the box. And ban the box means that in at least the initial application, in at least the initial part of a process for public employment or sometimes employment in general, the job application is not going to ask about criminal record unless there's an absolute bar. So let's say it's a law enforcement job and a felony conviction is an absolute bar. In that case, they might ask at the initial stage. But they'll wait until the person has a job offer. And at that point, they'll ask about the criminal record. And then in the context of the total person, in the context of all of the information that the employer has about the applicant whom they now want to hire, then they'll say, okay, does this criminal record change things? Or is it so far in the past and so contradicted by evidence of good behavior in the years since that criminal conviction that we're going to go ahead and hire this person? So that's something that's happened in a lot of cities and states around the country. And the view is that this gives people with criminal records a chance to make a living without unduly impairing public safety. Another thing that's happened is that there are a number of states in recent years have added methods to have a criminal record sealed, expunged, or overcome by a, let's say, a certificate of rehabilitation or a certificate of good conduct. And the idea is that once somebody has paid their debt to society and once somebody has demonstrated by good behavior over a period of years, there should be a way for the judge that sentenced them or for a parole board or somebody else to take a look at their record and say, we're ready to let you move on. If somebody has done what they're supposed to do, they've made a mistake in the past, you know, the evidence indicates that criminality, criminal behavior declines with age. And so older people are less likely to commit crimes than younger people. And so if we have somebody who looks like they're headed in the right direction, they might be able, there are more and more states that are allowing them to have their records sealed, expunged, or in some other way, some indication that they're no longer the person they were and they should be treated like everybody else in society.
Jack Chin is a law professor at the University of California, Davis. He's also the director of clinical legal education. He's in Milwaukee today to present this year's George and Margaret Barrick Lecture on Criminal Law at Marquette. He spoke with Joy Powers, and there is more information about the event at WUWM.com.
Lake Effect Susan Benz updates us on developments in the Wisconsin State Senate yesterday. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The Wisconsin State Senate took up several key pieces of legislation at the state capitol in Madison yesterday.
Lake Effect Susan Bentz followed a couple of them, one to ease restrictions for sulfide mining, the other to eliminate a requirement that a child must be at least 10 years old to participate in Wisconsin's hunting mentorship program. Susan reports on how the Senate vote fell.
Senators took on myriad bills throughout the day and evening on Tuesday, including a number of proposals dealing with the state's natural resources. Along the way, the Republican-heavy body glided through a measure that loosens wetland restoration requirements for public utilities. And in a rare bipartisan moment, the Senate unanimously passed a bill that would allow farmers to grow industrial hemp through a licensing program. But there was zero harmony when it came to a bill that eases requirements for mining sulfides, elements such as copper and zinc. Senator John Erpenbach tried his hand at striking a bipartisan chord. The Democrat from Middleton reminded colleagues of a bill approved 20 years ago that the new sulfide bill would replace. The statute is often called the Prove It First Law because it mandates that companies prove they won't cause environmental damage before setting up a new mine.
What happened in 97... was an extremely proud moment for the Wisconsin State Legislature and the governor of Wisconsin at the time. You don't get that strong of a vote on that tough of an issue unless everybody at the time, Democrats and Republicans alike, including Governor Thompson, felt that way. That was historic what happened back in 97. Historic. And here we are today, thinking we know better because the mining companies have told us that, well, new technology, don't worry about it, isn't good enough. It's not a good enough reason to change the law.
But Erpenbach's concerns and those raised by a string of Democratic senators were met with silence from Republicans. The bill's proponents, notably lead advocate Senator Tom Tiffany, favor changing the law because they insist it will preserve core environmental protections while creating much-needed jobs in northern Wisconsin. Another natural resources measure that captured its share of attention was a special hunting bill. It would eliminate the minimum age requirement for hunters. Children, including those under age 10, would be able to hunt with adult supervision. Republican Senator Terry Moulton of Chippewa Falls urged Democrats to approve the measure.
What would be wrong with allowing a 5, 8, 9-year-old to hunt with a mentor under supervision? This bill simply allows Wisconsin to align our law with 34 other states, including all of our neighbors around us. If this bill passed the assembly in a bipartisan fashion, and I would hope that we could do the same here.
Several Democratic senators queued up to speak out against the proposal. Dave Hansen of Green Bay says his concern was shaped by a fatal shooting of a young boy back in 2005.
A 12-year-old boy accidentally shot and killed, I believe, his 14-year-old cousin boy while deer hunting in Marinette County. The 12-year-old wasn't familiar with the shotgun he was using and apparently thought the safety was on, the DNR said in a news release. He was carrying the shotgun while walking with a group of people and was not even trying to shoot a deer at the time. At that time, 12 years ago, I promised that family I would never support any deer hunting below the age of 12 because of this incident that took that 14-year-old's life.
The Senate approved the bill to remove the minimum age requirement by a vote of 19 to 14. It already passed in the Assembly and will be sent off to Governor Walker. The legislature is attempting to move quickly through a number of proposals. Lawmakers' work on many bills was delayed this past summer and early fall because the legislature was focused on finalizing an overdue state budget, along with pushing through the $3 billion Foxconn incentives package. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You can find more coverage of state government at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Wisconsin native Joe Kanosian returns to Milwaukee to perform in his hit show Murder for Two. We will chat with him next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Back with more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. From doo-wop to the blues, from Liberace to Broadway show tunes, Milwaukee Rep's Stackner Cabaret has seen a lot of small but powerful shows come to life on its stage. And this Friday evening, a show co-written by Wisconsin native Joe Kanosian will be added to the list.
Kanosian is from Mayfield and is a graduate of the Milwaukee High School of the Arts. His award-winning comedy slash musical slash murder mystery, Murder for Two, is a tour de force for two piano-playing actors. It debuted in Chicago in 2011, and the show has pretty much been in production somewhere ever since.
I recently caught up with Kanosian at the Rep before rehearsal to find out more.
Murder for Two is a two-person murder mystery comedy. I should say comedy first. It's more of a comedy than a murder mystery.
And a musical.
And a musical. And a multi-character, inventive, theatrical situation.
So I enjoyed reading it very much. I'm so looking forward.
Oh, you read it?
I did.
Okay, you're leaps and bounds ahead of every other interviewer. Usually they're like, wait, so this is a play? You wrote
a
play?
But, you know, I had to think of a lot of the wonderful two-person type things that you obviously are very fond of, things like Irma Vep,
mm-hmm.
The Mystery
yeah.
of Irma Vep. Was that one of the influences for you?
I knew about that play, but I promise you, I had not read it until we had a first draft of Murder for Two. And then so I'm from Wisconsin originally. My writing partner and his wife and I were in Door County, and they did it at Peninsula Players the summer after we drafted it, and we saw it, and we're like, oh, yeah, now I see why people are always saying that they're similar. Well, I will say the difference with Murder for Two and also with 39 Steps, which we also get compared to, which I love because that was an amazing play I saw many, many times. In those shows, you have the multi-character tracks. Like, you see them as each character, like, in turn, one at a time. And Murder for Two, I'm just sort of everybody at the same time, which is, I guess, a novelty. See, it's different.
It is different. It is so much fun because as I was reading it, because, of course, as you're reading it on the page, you're imagining what it sounds like. And I was thinking, okay, there's such rapid-fire changes, particularly as things start to come together or unravel at the end, depending on how you look at it, and all is revealed. You and your acting partner are like five people a second.
Yeah, it's pretty rapid fire for sure. I mean, that was you know, one of the things we wanted to do was to, like, how far can we push this so-called limit? You know, how far can we take this conceits? And also, once you start it and people kind of get the game that I'm playing a bunch of characters, which is pretty much just the opening number, like that reveal, then it's like, well, where do you go from there? How do you make it faster and more difficult and more crazy and more hectic and fun and all that stuff?
So give me a little backstory. When did this first start? When did this start percolating between you and your writing partner?
I met my writing partner fall of 2008 at the BMI Musical Theater Writers Workshop in New York. And previous to that, I had written some musicals by myself that never went anywhere or anything happened with. So I thought this workshop would be a good place to, you know, give me deadlines and to network with other writers and also, finish projects that I had started, hopefully. And I wasn't looking for a writing partner, but Kellen Blair was in class and his lyrics were just incredible and really surpassed what I was able to do on my own. And, you know, we talked and he was certainly looking for someone to write with. And we originally planned to write this enormous 30-actor, huge orchestra, period piece, two-act musical to do in the second year of the workshop.
What, may I ask?
I don't know if I should say in case we ever go back to it. But I will. Let's say it's about the hatchet-wielding temperance leader from Kansas in the early 1900s. I think there's only one. But at least it's
as far as we know.
You might say she carried a nation. We always found that character interesting. So if you're a writer and you're listening to this, please don't steal that idea. We might come back. Anyway, point is, that was going to be our second year project. And we had like a summer to kill, and Kellen was handing out flyers in Times Square, like half-price tickets to a Broadway show. And I was doing an off-Broadway musical called Dear Edwina. And we started talking about something we could fill the summer with. And we were like, well, what if we wrote a show that we could self-produce that had, you know, as few actors as possible, as few instrumentalists as possible, and no production demands? You know, you could do it with a set, but you wouldn't have to. So that was where the idea came along. I mean, that was the technical part of the idea. The nuts and bolts of it were that we were both huge fans of old movies, 1930s sort of slapstick and screwball comedy in particular, you know, the Marx Brothers and the Thin Man films and Preston Sturges and reference points like that. So the notion became, without adapting this story from any pre-existing material, what would it be like if fictitious Marx Brothers put on a fictitious Agatha Christie story? So that was sort of the notion, and we went from there.
I love the idea of the Marx Brothers doing an Agatha Christie mystery.
Because it almost seems like maybe they did, and we just don't remember it, like, thinking back.
Right. I know I saw that film late night sometime, and if not, they should have.
They really should have.
Yeah.
Couldn't agree more.
I love it.
And they'll be doing it November 10th through January 14th.
So from idea to actually getting it on stage the first time, how long did it actually take you to put it together?
I always talk about how lucky we were, and it sounds like I'm being falsely modest, but we were so, so lucky. From the first reading to the first full production was less than a year, which never, ever, ever happens. And it was a combination of being in the right place at the right time a couple of times and presenting it to just the right person at the time when they were looking for something. And also, the year we did it, the first time we had a first full production was 2010, which means that the theaters were looking for things in 2009 when the economy was tanking and they were canceling all the big shows they were going to do. I was supposed to be in a world premiere of a new musical that was just like our Carrie Nation story, like this massive production. It was supposed to be at La Jolla Playhouse. And, you know, it was going to be my big break. And it was this amazing new show that they were putting together like late 2008, 2009. And, you know, the economy tanked and they canceled their season and replaced it with the 39 Steps. And this was just as we were starting to write Murder for Two. So we're like, all right, let's read the tea leaves a little bit and see, you know, what this means for what we're about to do.
And good thing.
And it totally. It was, we like to say, it was inadvertently the best business decision we ever made. And it was not, we weren't being shrewd and calculating and putting our fingers together like Mr. Burns, like envisioning how this would go. We just I guess we just responded.
Like any two-person show, it requires some amazing performance capabilities of the two actors who were doing it.
Mm-hmm. And they couldn't find them, so they got us.
So yeah, you ended up, well, you were saving money, right?
That's such a hacky joke, yeah.
You didn't have to pay yourselves very much?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we are paying Matt Edmonds, who's doing it with me here. But no, in the early days, it was totally a means to an end. It was like I was a piano-playing actor who could, you know, do character voices. And I was also an actor who was more comfortable behind the piano than outside of the piano, than away from the piano, I should say. And so 100%, I mean, I was an actor who would work for free. And the other actor who would work for, maybe not free, but very little when we first wrote it, was our friend Marcus, who, he doesn't play the piano. And in the early versions, I did all the piano playing, which really was very lopsided. And we realized we had to make the change. So unfortunately, Marcus couldn't do the play anymore, but we named the character Marcus in his honor because he did so much to help us. Yes,
okay.
Yes, Marcus Stevens, who's like a forbidden Broadway actor who is great in the part. He just doesn't play piano.
Right. I imagine, even though I have not heard the cast recording, I imagine that there's some pretty, like the acting, you have to be a pretty good piano player too.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it's demanding. And, you know, I'm you know, in rehearsals here with Matt, who's never done it before, and I'm seeing him learn it for the first time, and I'm like, oh, I really take for granted that, like, of course, this is, like, in my fingers. I've done it almost 600 times, and I, you know, wrote it. So it's like, that's a, yeah, it is, it's tough. But hopefully, you know, that's part of the fun of seeing it, too, is, like, the showiness of all this ridiculously indulgent faux classical piano playing.
Yeah. With there's a lot of little stage directions in the script. It's like, you know, what is it? Tension music or something like that, where you play the stereotypical, like, dun 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 dun.
I know just what you're referring to. And it is funny for people who don't know how it goes when they read that stage direction, exactly what you're saying. It's Yonkers plays the expected dramatic chords. Yeah.
And I have to say that you mentioned Yonkers, the three kids.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Who are part of a 12-person chorus.
Yes.
Who, they're the only three left.
Nine of them are sadly no longer with us.
Sadly no longer with us. Yeah. And so, you know, that's hearkening back to all of those wonderful movies from the 30s, and you hear the same, and they even have a song that
they
fits
sure
perfectly.
Do. Yes, and the detective has discovered that there's been this 12-member boys choir in the room the whole time that he was not made aware of earlier. This is on page 40, so do with that what you will. But he realizes that kids shouldn't be at a crime scene and needs to usher them out as quickly as possible. And they assure him that they've seen much worse.
We've been around the block a time or two and seen a lot, all right. Don't imagine that we're not all right, cause we've seen a lot worse. To tell the truth, if we was younger, we'd be getting sicker now. But our skin's a little thicker now, cause we've seen a lot worse. We seen a fella torn in two one day by a gorilla at the zoo one day. We hardly ever make it through one day without a glimpse of horror. No need to intervene, we seen a lot worse.
I remember what it felt like to be your age, Timmy.
The Little Rascals.
Yeah, and East Side Kids and
East Side Kids.
Bowery Boys or Bowery Kids, something like that too. Yeah, there's another one. Yeah, for sure.
I'm
that's
only surprised you didn't have a dog.
Oh, that's a good point. There is a cat. There's a cat who gets, it's better. The less said about what happens to the cat, the better. But
the cat's off stage. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't a dog. You know, this is the one thing you could
have
thrown in
the
there.
Line somewhere.
Somewhere. Well, you're not changing costumes like Irma Vep. At least you're not doing that.
Yes. And that was another thing that was just a means to an end that wound up being like kind of, I think, if I can say this, like something special about the show was that, you know, at no point are you looking at a man in a blonde wig just trying to say like he's playing like this young female graduate student. It's like, how can I just make that person more real without that stuff? How can I just do it with the way I'm holding myself and the way I'm using my voice? And I like that challenge. And I think it's asking the audience to meet you halfway that is part of the interactive fun of it.
I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the show's production. Obviously, there's a cast, a formal cast recording. Mm-hmm. Lots of other places have done it. Mm-hmm. Is this one of those things that you're going to be getting royalties from as you go on? Are people really still excited to do it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it. I hope so. Everything about what's happened to this play has been so wonderfully unexpected. And, you know, we wrote it to amuse our friends while we had a summer free, a couple of months free. And imagine that, you know, this other big show we were working on was going to be the thing that happened. And that's just not how it was. And it's just amazing, you know, that this play ever happened, that I got to do it, that I've gotten to do it all over the country, that now the play has been all over the world. You know, we got to see it in England and Japan, and it's been in Korea and China and Argentina and yes. How can I sound any more humbled and profound? It's like, it's incredible.
Dare I ask about other shows? What else have you got percolating? Or are you just so busy with this that you haven't had time to write?
No, luckily, that's what I was going to say, because you had given me that wonderful prompt about like how this has like changed, you know, the trajectory of your career. And like, The royalties are, it's a great, like I said, unexpected bonus. But what's been really great is like, now if a theater does this play, they kind of have a handle on what Kellen's and my style is and what we think is funny. Hopefully what they think is funny. And it's just been so great to like opening up doors and starting conversations is like, you know, we have this thing we did that maybe you've seen or heard about. To that end, yes, we started working on another show pretty much right when Murder for Two opened in New York, which was summer of 2013. And so as opposed to Murder for Two's development, which was an absolute whirlwind, which was a year to that first full production and then 2 years from start time to the world premiere in Chicago, this one is taking a much more standard developmental pace. And we've done, let's see, like four readings and a big workshop over the last couple of years. And we just did a big presentation to a bunch of our friends who are regional theater representatives, and we recorded a full demo to start sending out. So hopefully that one will be in production sometime soon.
And we'll talk when it happens, yes?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. To. Coming to Milwaukee Rep, and this time we're going to be on the Quadracci Powerhouse. Excuse me.
None of those little, like, cabaret spaces.
No, you bring a beverage and you're done. Oh, wait, you can bring beverages.
Can bring,
never mind.
It,
okay.
It's covered.
Bring whatever you want. Just give us the bigger theater.
Exactly.
Just kidding. I'm kidding. Okay.
Exactly.
Yes, that'll be coming to Milwaukee Rep in 2025, let's say. Let's be conservative.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hope that the development doesn't take quite that long.
Yeah.
But anyway, Joe, I want to thank you for taking time out of rehearsal to talk with me. And welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Milwaukee native Joe Kanosian returns to town to perform in Murder for Two at the Milwaukee Rep's Stackner Cabaret along with Matt Edmonds. Kanosian co-wrote the show with Kellen Blair.
Murder for Two opens this Friday, and there is more information about the production at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio concert from Irish band Skipper's Alley. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. The band Skipper's Alley has found a following in some places far from their home in Dublin. The Irish band has played throughout the United States, on a St. Patrick's Day tour in the African nation of Zambia, and last month they played at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center here in Milwaukee.
They joined us in the studio ahead of that show and talked with Joy Powers about the nature of traditional music.
Thank you all so much for being here in studio with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
So you set up your tour here earlier this month. This is maybe an odd question, but did you have any trouble getting here? We've heard from a lot of artists that it's suddenly become a little bit more difficult to enter the U.S.
You know, thankfully, we haven't had too many issues getting into the country. We've got a good agent who does out our immigration for us, and he knows all the tricks of the trade by this stage. But yeah, it can be pretty hard, and I hear it's getting harder.
Did you have any expectations coming to the U.S. this time around? I know you've been here a couple times before, but it seems like listening to people from the international community that the perception of the United States has certainly changed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people talk and talk is cheap. I mean, I have family from the U.S. I always understood both sides of it. But yeah, no, I didn't have any negative expectations coming here. We knew what we were getting in for.
Good, good. So where have you gone before Milwaukee?
Well, when we came here in March, we were in Boston, and we did the East Coast, Virginia, West Virginia, and that kind of area, California, and then Texas for one gig, and then Colorado and Wyoming. And yeah, strangely enough. I don't know, where did this go?
On the Midwest then as well, like a good bit of the Midwest around here. This is the first time Milwaukee, but Chicago and Ohio and Michigan.
Kentucky.
Island, yeah. Michigan, yeah.
All right, so you have a song for us, Butcher's March. Anything that we should expect?
They're two kind of old tunes. The kind of style was taken from some old pipers that were recorded kind of the early part of the 20th century. And yeah, very much inspired by them. Thank you.
That was Butcher's March from Skipper's Alley. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I'm somewhat of an outsider to trad music. I've always wondered how traditional is being defined here. So when we're talking about Irish music and trad music in Ireland, are we talking about music, and this might not be the right way to say this, but pre or post Oliver Cromwell?
Neither one nor the other. I think it existed through that period. Neither pre nor post, just the native and ethnic music of Ireland is basically traditional music in its,
The music we play, most of it isn't more than 200 years old, you know? So, you know, it's a subjective thing what we're talking about. You know, we're not saying we're the people defining what traditional music is. And playing in a group, that's not necessarily traditional, you know? Actually, it's not.
Like
the pipes and the harp are probably the two oldest instruments we have, and their music was solo music, you know? So I suppose a lot of traditionalists at home now would, and, you know, we'd be included in that, I suppose. Like, the stuff that we really enjoy is the solo playing. And for me, anyway, it's the pinnacle of what we're trying to do. But as a group, it's a different dynamic completely. You know, group playing in traditional music is probably only around since the 60s, when Sean O'Rea brought it to the stage at home. And I think that's basically...
Interesting. Now, you're all very young, and it seems like a lot of trad players are pretty young. Where do you see trad music right now? What does trad music mean today?
Yeah, I guess that's a little bit unusual. I suppose a lot of traditional music, it's something that's for the older generations, whereas in Ireland, there's a pretty widespread, like, education system for Irish music. You know, like, there's a lot of branches that teach specifically in parts all over the country, so you'll have a lot of young people, probably, I mean, I couldn't say for definite, but maybe more young people than old people playing these days, that keeps it going. In terms of where Irish music is today, that's a very, very broad question with a lot of meanings, but certainly a massive part of the youth population in Ireland are playing Irish music, yeah.
And where do you see yourselves in this kind of grand tradition of Irish music? Where do you see your music?
As a band, it's a different genre of music, you know. It's not really Irish traditional music, you know. Mm. So, we just enjoy arranging music. Mm. And, you know, most of our practice would go into playing solo, you know. And then this is just a different thing that we happen to be into, you know, and interested in. And so from that perspective, I kind of split the two completely. It's not...
At the same time, we're trying to, like, represent traditional styles as a group unit in a scene that's mainly, a lot of the time, not representative of old styles. It's kind of a thing that's become more diluted and more modern, you know. So our place is in that pool, but it's definitely representative of those old styles, and we try to at least bring that across.
Yeah, in terms of our position, I suppose, on the whole map, if you look at Irish music as an entire map, you know, from a spectrum from solo traditional playing, where it's very much kind of pure, and then the whole other end of the spectrum, we like to think of ourselves as somewhere in the middle, verging on the, certainly on the side of the ensembles and the contemporary music, but taking a lot of influence from the pure and solo traditional Irish music.
We take influence as a band from the, like, virtuoso players in the tradition, you know, and in our arrangements. That's something that we would bring over from, let's say, the pure traditional music to our arrangements. And that one that you heard there, like, the main thing in that arrangement was me playing these regulators in the first tune anyway. That's the thing that stands out. They're the buttons that I play chords with. But that comes directly from a piper that recorded that in the early 20th century in the States. So that's the type of thing that we would do a lot, try and kind of, you know, there was a lot of mad stuff going on, you know, in solo playing, and there still is,
mad, you know. But maybe it wasn't so mad back then.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, as I say, the scene has been diluted, everything's been standardised, everything's become watered down almost.
Yeah.
And we're kind of looking back to that as inspiration, as opposed to, like, you know, it's really hard to find inspiration in something that's been so standardised, you know, so watered down. I don't know.
well, we find it hard. We'd find the old stuff more interesting, if you get me.
Some of your songs are actually written in Irish. Do all of you speak Irish?
No, not all of us. I don't.
Varying degrees of it.
Well, I have,
a bit of Irish. We all have a little bit.
Everyone has learned Irish here. Well, some people went further with it than others as well.
Yeah.
But nobody, I don't think, in this room anyway, speaks it at home. And that's...
Well, Finn,
I do.
Which your parents have?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, well, I was raised true Irish, mainly at home. Went to a true Irish education system, but the lads would have really good Irish as well. We would speak it together the odd time, not too often.
Certainly understand it at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. We could understand it mostly, and I could probably have a conversation in Irish, even though grammatically I'm probably all over the place, but... Yeah, I suppose not. I've never really thought about that. But,
It's probably worthy to note that we would be a little bit unusual in our level of Irish and that we're members of the kind of traditional music community for which Irish is quite important, whereas maybe perhaps the general population wouldn't be so much so. A lot of the average Joes in Ireland probably wouldn't have much Irish, just whatever they learned at school. But beyond that, get a few years out of school, they would. So we'd be, unusual in that regard. Yeah.
Now, you said you were raised true Irish. I don't exactly know what that means.
Irish up until I was maybe 15 or, I remember clearly around 15 or 16, the language in the house changed to English when me and my brother were probably going through a stage where we've kind of felt the language wasn't a cool thing, and we felt a bit out of place with the thing. But up until then, it was always the language of my house, and we've gone back to it recently. But it can be hard to make that switch back, Like, obviously, when we had friends in the house, it was always true English, so... making that divide isn't easy.
Do you feel like traditional Irish music is informed by the language now?
There's a similar music in the language, I think. Can't even explain how important it is to have a knowledge of the language for your own music. Mm-hmm. And like one of the really well-known pipers of the 20th century, Willie Clancy, he didn't have a word of Irish. Well, he had a bit of Irish, but he said he would swap all his musical abilities for a knowledge of the Irish language. And he worked hard on improving his Irish, especially for if you're playing airs to songs and that, which is part of our tradition. You need to really have some sort of knowledge of the phrasing and that. But I think it's a very similar music in the language. I don't know why it is, but I hear the same thing.
There are certainly a lot of linguists and anthropologists who would study the rhythms and the sounds of Irish music and compare it to the diction and the intonation of the language as well. I mean, that's pretty common held belief in terms of the actual formation of it, which is true around the world in a lot of places. So yeah, I would very much say they inform one another.
So we have another song from you. Not in Irish, I don't believe.
No.
It's She's a Gay Old Hag.
Yes, indeed.
So that's an interesting title. What is that about?
I wish I could tell you that if you listen to the lyrics in the song, they're pretty jumbled and don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I guess there's just a particular tradition in Irish song that's a little bawdy and a little bit raucous, and this just comes from that. Perhaps not the most broadcasted form of Irish song, but certainly a very strong and important part of it.
Skipper's Alley, recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. They spoke with Joy Powers and were here last month for a performance at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR Milwaukee.
Fresher comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.